Welcome to another episode of Chinuch Today. Finally, I get to interview a very dear friend, Dr. Eli Shapiro, who is the founder and director of the Digital Citizen Project. Welcome, Dr. Shapiro, who we will call Eli going forward.
Hey, thank you. I've been waiting for the invite. I've been sitting for almost 3 years now, just waiting for the phone call to be called up in the minor leagues. And waiting to be called up to the majors. And
this is going to be a major career change for you. And I hope their bandwidth on your website is going to be able to handle the additional traffic. We'll see.
EliShapiro.com for those that might want to just go straight
check
to
it
the
out. Yeah. Let's get right to the plug. Yeah. Okay, so you have a very cool project, which we're going to talk about, which focuses on digital citizenship and computer usage. And you really were like the forerunner on that. And we're going to get to that. But before, let's get to the man, Dr. Eli Shapiro, the man himself. And as I was reflecting on introducing you, you are someone who has a lot of anomalies because you have a doctorate in education, but your day job is like in social work, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. What do you do in
your day job? I'm a licensed clinical social worker.
There you go. Okay, so you're an educator and a social worker. Yeah. And then you work for the consortium a lot, and your wife works for Tarmasora.
Yes, we're in a mixed marriage.
Yeah. And then you speak at like all different venues from the left to the right. So you're like, I don't know, you're just an interesting guy. You know, you got a lot going on.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I feel blessed that that's the truth, that I get to work in with diverse groupings and, you know, within the vast spectrum of the Jewish community. It's an honor for me to have that opportunity. So I really feel blessed for that opportunity and that my work has been adopted, as you said, you know, left to right in various groupings within the Jewish community. And I'm certainly proud of that. And again, I feel blessed to be able to do that.
I think it speaks a lot to you that you're able to understand the different communities and be respected by them. It's an impressive feat. So let's start. Where'd you grow up?
That's a great question.
It's a really sophisticated question. You'll never get that on a podcast.
Yeah. So, no, interestingly enough, I don't think I've ever been asked where I grew up, but that's why you know, the king of podcasts.
They call me the podcast king for nothing.
Asked the questions that no one else asks. But yeah, I actually grew up in Brooklyn.
Did you hear that, listeners? Eli Shapiro grew up in Brooklyn. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
where'd you go to high school?
Elementary school. I went to Chaim Berlin, and I went to high school Chabad Chaim in Rochester.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Spent 4 years in Rochester, which was an amazing, amazing experience. It's an amazing yeshiva. And a city like Rochester builds resilience and grit. You know, it's a harsh environment, not the yeshiva, but the city itself. Like they say there, there's two seasons. There's winter and August. So those are the two seasons of Rochester. And then I was in Shari Yashiv for a number of years in Far Rockaway and never left Far Rockaway.
Did you go to Eretz Yisrael at all?
I spent a year in Eretz Yisrael at Or David.
Is that still around? I haven't heard about that.
Yeah. They I think they took a year off to restructure, but it's still around. It's been around. It's one of the older yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael.
Right. Awesome. Okay, and then you got first your degree in social work?
I went to Touro College. I got a degree in psychology. And with the degree in psychology, I actually wasn't sure if I wanted to go into psychology or social work. I was looking at two options. I felt social work was a broader field with different opportunities than psychology. So I got a master's in social work. And then post-master's, I was working for a couple of years in outpatient drug rehab as a clinical social worker.
Wow.
Doing drug treatment. I attended Queens College post-master's graduate program in education, where I got two licenses in school administration. So I actually licensed as a public school administrator, which I don't work as a public school administrator, but did get those licenses, and worked for an agency called BOCES, New York State, part of the New York State Education Department. I've been with them for 21 years. And during that time, I also pursued a doctorate in education through Azrieli. My master's was from Wurzweiler at Yeshiva University, and then my doctorate was from Azrieli, which I was, you know, it was interesting because I was asked, why education? You're in the clinical field. But a lot of my work was school-based. And the truth is, the vast majority of my work was education, both in the social-emotional sense, But some of my favorite people were at Azrieli, Dr. Rona Novick, Dr. David Palkovitz. And so the opportunity, who are both mental health professionals, so the opportunity to, continue my education with them was very exciting to me.
Interesting. And so, at what point did you think you wanted to do what? Meaning, when you were getting, let's say, your first master's, what did you have in mind? Like, what was your professional goal with that?
When I was getting my first master's, my interest was in substance abuse amongst adolescents in the Orthodox community. So that was
Why?
really the focus.
How'd you get into that?
There were just different people that I saw the impact. It could be that I'm a little oppositional and I wanted to deal with topics that other people didn't want to talk about. So this is in the late 90s. At-risk youth was starting to be a conversation, but substance abuse was very much not discussed in yeshiva settings. Particularly, and so I had written my master's thesis on substance abuse amongst adolescents in the Orthodox community, which at the time was, again, really not discussed. So I wanted to focus on that. I started working in an outpatient drug rehab in the Five Towns. And
Were a lot of
what
those patients Jewish Orthodox?
I would say a significant percentage, it was reflective of the overall population, a significant percentage of the agency was from the Jewish community, broad spectrum. But again, that's more of geographical, I think, than indicative of anything else. But I was working predominantly with their Orthodox population. But what I was finding was that the Orthodox adolescents that were substance abusing were also going to yeshivas and day schools. And my interest then shifted to working with Jewish day schools and yeshivas because, sort of, from a preventative model. I was also finding that there was a lot of self-esteem issues and challenges with emotional functioning, that the substances, in many ways, were the answer rather than the problem. They were the solution to whatever kids were dealing with. And so I saw a lot of bullying and low self-esteem and victimization, and along those lines. And that, I would say, in the early 2000s is when I met Dr. Rona Novick, who at that point was at LIJ, Long Island Jewish Hospital, in Long Island, hence the name Long Island Jewish Hospital. And she introduced me to the bully prevention programming, and I started,
Brave.
yeah,
Woohoo.
brave. Yeah, brave. But
I
yeah, this
dealt
was.
with Brave, one of her first schools. So yeah, you're going back to like 2003 or something.
Yeah.
And I was a school counselor in Atlanta and we brought her in. And is she still doing that? Is that still a thing?
I don't know if I she definitely still does consulting and work on bully prevention. I don't know if Brave
All right.
is in a formal way that it was. It was really, a lot of it was based on the work of Dan Olweis, who was one of the leading thinkers and researchers on bully prevention. But this was early in my career. This was over 20 years ago. That was really my focus. So bully prevention and social emotional functioning in schools, and that was really where my work was. And
So
it,
what, let me just
yeah.
understand something. You were working in the clinic. How would you get paid to do that work in the schools? Was there another
So yeah,
role?
so it was interesting. It was a 2 year period that I worked right out of graduate school. 2 year period that I worked in the substance abuse program, and just from a matter of functionality. The drug treatment agency, most of the work that they did was in the afternoons and evenings. So, from a financial standpoint, if they could develop contracts with schools to place their social workers in schools, then they could cover half the paycheck of their employee and all the downtime of the midday. Yeah, so it was really a matter of function. So, I ended up being an entree for them into Jewish day schools because they didn't have a relationship. So, it was sort of a win-win situation where I got to work in yeshivas. During the mornings, and then the afternoons, I would go over to the agency and one night a week
Okay,
work
that's
there.
very significant. So you were really
Yeah.
working in Jewish day schools, firsthand experience about what was going on. And so you really could
Yeah.
have gone either way. You could have stayed in Jewish day schools in like a formal way. It sounds like you were considering administration. Is that something that was on your mind?
A little later, not so much to go into administration, but what was interesting that I was only in the working in this drug rehab for 2 years. I ended up getting hired on the third year out of graduate school by an agency called BOCES, Board of Cooperative Education Services. And then they placed me back in yeshivas because, without going into all the details of it, public school districts are required to provide equitable supplementary education to their non-public schools in their districts. So I ended up getting hired by the public school system and then placed back in yeshivas to be a school social worker.
What kind of schools were you in? Were you in one school or moved around? What
So I
was
would
the
say over the last 20 years, I've been probably about 15 different schools, half of them yeshivas, some of them independent schools, and some public school settings. So
Wow.
different locations.
That's some serious experience and seeing a school from a certain perspective, I guess. It gives you a lot of insight.
And so, yeah, I was very much focused on the affective domain of education. When I was growing up in yeshiva, there was no such thing as the affective domain of education. No one was concerned about how we felt about coming to school or, how we felt about our teachers and rabbeim. No one cared about that. So for me, it was an opportunity to address what the research indicates is that, the affective domain of education informs the cognitive domain. So if you want successful students, they need to feel comfortable, they need to feel happy, they need to feel safe. And so I was very much focused on that in developing positive programming. So in one school that I was working at, we developed what looks like a PBIS program. I was unfamiliar with PBIS at the time, but it was really about promoting pro-social behavior. Just to go back, we had introduced the Brave Bully Prevention Program, but I wanted to incorporate not just negative behaviors like don't do this or don't do that. It was about what can we do to promote kids engaging in positive peer relations. And so through developing that, it was really about shifting school culture and creating an environment that kids would feel comfortable and feel safe in. And also a byproduct of that was substance abuse prevention, because if kids felt good about being in school with their peer groups and not feeling victimized and feeling like a positive environment, they were less likely to substance abuse as well. So that was definitely like what my early career focus was.
Well, we could just talk about this for the rest of the podcast, but I know we'll get sidetracked, but I have to mention two things. Number one is you mentioned it in passing, but it's such an important thing to focus on is the impact of the emotional feeling that children have on their academic performance. As at a school right now, I put a lot of emphasis on that, and sometimes people see it as distracting from academics. Like, why are you so nice to kids? Why do you care so much? Why do you work so hard to make it a welcoming environment? We have to have rigor. We have to push the kids. They have to know no monkey business, you know? And my gut, and it sounds like you're saying the research is that if kids feel loved and comfortable and emotionally calm, they do achieve more academically, not less.
Kids will perform for the teachers they feel a connection to. Even weak students, if they feel connected to the teacher, my wife talks about this. She does workshops on conscious discipline and always about connection before correction. It's always about building the relationship before you correct, before you educate. And so finding that piece of it, whether it's with the students or whether it's with the teachers or the administration, creating an environment and a school culture where kids feel supported and welcome is going to just in and of itself should be enough to want to do that, that it's a
Right.
positive thing. But also the academic outcomes are also positive as well. One of the first opportunities that I had to really do this was with Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Yaffe at Masifta Teres Yaakov, who he himself, not only is he the Rosh Yeshiva, he's also a clinical psychologist. So he really understood that relationship between the affective domain and student functioning.
I'll tell you, one of our colleagues, currently Rabbi Dr. Meir Cohen, who's the head of school in Atlanta, of Torah Day School of Atlanta, just became a doctor through Azrieli. And I had the honor of sitting on his doctoral committee. So I heard his thesis and his dissertation presented. And it was on this very point. He studied groups of kids who were put in a structure to do pro-social behavior. That means to be friendly or to go out of their way to be nice. And he correlated that with their academic performance and found that kids who did more positive social behaviors and felt better about themselves over time did better academically, which is very much aligned with what you're saying.
Yeah, so that I mean, that was definitely what my focus was, and the reason I started exploring education administration, I wasn't particularly interested in going into it, but I wanted to understand schools as an organization and as a system, because in order what I was finding is in order for me to implement some of the ideas I had around programming, basically the implementation of programming. Not just the concepts around it. I needed to better understand the system of a school and what are administrators looking at organizationally and systemically and board members, et cetera. So at that point, I went to the Queens College Graduate School of Education and pursued administration training that happened to result in New York, two different New York State licenses in
Wow.
school administration.
It's so interesting how my experiences mimicked yours in a lot of ways, and yet we went different paths. Because I started out, I got a degree in counseling from Hopkins when I was in Baltimore, and then I was a Rebbe, but in the afternoon I was a school counselor, similar role. And I had no thought of being a principal at that time. It wasn't even on my mind. But as I was the school counselor role, and I saw the similar type of challenges, the systemic challenges that I thought were setting up kids not for the success that we want them to do, I also thought, how could I influence this? But my result was to get state certified in principalship, and I went back and got a further degree and ended up also getting a doctorate. And that was the way I was planning on influence it. And I could say that for one school in Texas, we pulled it off, I think. But your model is a little different, but we both had the same experience by being in schools and seeing how much growth there could be in this area. So I think that's really interesting.
It also it informed my work with Consortium of Jewish Day Schools as well. Thinking about things systemically and best practices and the social emotional functioning of students and the affective domain of education. I'm not familiar with curriculum and cognitive aspects of education, but school culture and connections and faculty relationships and school leadership and understanding that domain and human behavior. Is the approach that I take both in Consortium of Jewish Day Schools and in having developed the Digital Citizenship Project.
Okay, so you were doing the social work at night, going to schools during the day. You got your the master's, the postmaster's, and then the doctorate. Was the next major career thing the consortium or the Digital Citizen Project?
So Digital Citizenship Project preceded Consortium by a couple of years.
Tell us, how'd you get into that? And
As I said, I went to Azrieli mainly because some of my heroes were there. When I started Azrieli, they had just started the Institute for University School Partnership, and I with Dr. Scott Goldberg was running. He was the head of doctoral studies at the time that I started there, and so they had tapped a number of their incoming students to be project managers for the Institute of University School Partnership. So I was doing actually two different projects for them. One was school affordability, and one was Dr. Novick's Brave program. So I was a project manager for that. I was already pretty familiar with Brave because I was running it before she had gone to Azrieli, and it was a very natural fit. And in my work with her on bully prevention, we started looking at cyberbullying. As it was an emerging issue. This goes back, I guess it was 2007,
Was that like
2008.
IM? Was that what that was? AOL, Instant
It was
Messenger.
AOL and Messenger. Yeah, but it was before high school kids had phone. 2007 was, it was like you think about 2007 is when the iPhone came out. So it wasn't that ubiquitous, amongst the kids. But we were starting to see cyberbullying on a college. The research was relatively new on it. We were seeing it on a college level. And so we had started looking at that. She had added a couple of questions to the surveys. Every school that we worked with, we collected data from. That was a lot of my job was collecting data and entering data. But we were collecting data, and it included questions about cyberbullying. And so when it came time to pick a topic for my dissertation, I felt that cyberbullying was something to look at. What's the prevalence of it? What are the rates of it? Is it similar or different to what we see in the published data in the public school population? Are the kids who cyberbully the same kids who do traditional bullying? It was sort of that next step from traditional bullying to cyberbullying. And so that was what my dissertation was on. It was on cyberbullying amongst middle school students attending modern Orthodox Jewish day schools. My hypothesis was that, we are a values-based education system. We would have lower rates of cyberbullying. And my hypothesis was unfortunately wrong. We actually had the same rates as the published data. And qualitatively, it was different. The cyberbullying was different in amongst yeshiva students than the public school population. But it was there at the same rate, and it was relative to the communal standards and expectations. And yeah, so we, that was surprising, but it reinforced some of the findings that I had earlier with substance abuse, is that the same challenges that we're reading about in the newspapers and that we're hearing about in the secular and public school population, we were experiencing those same challenges, we maybe weren't discussing or talking about.
And so, how did you get to your own organization?
So, in doing the research on cyberbullying, it was really trying to understand why do people misbehave online? Why are they aggressive? Why are they mean? What we found was that people who weren't necessarily traditional bullies in a school setting would cyberbully. So
Oh.
they were mostly different kids. The truth is, anyone who was a traditional bully, it was like 99% of traditional bullies, also cyberbullied. But the kids that were cyberbullying weren't necessarily traditional bullies. And so the question is, why is the behavior different? And so in the research on that, we were finding, well, it impacts individuals socially and psychologically and behaviorally. And we were seeing online, people tend to be more impulsive. They tend to be more disinhibited. They tend to be more compulsive. And so in looking at all these behaviors, I was seeing that the challenges of technology were much greater than what the communal conversation about technology was. And at that point, this is 2012, 2013, the conversation around technology was schmutz and filters. That was the complete dialogue around it. And I was frustrated because I knew that the challenges were so much more. And so I began in my own head, developing what I thought some of the challenges were that really needed to be discussed. Now it's interesting, we are recording this. It's Chaf Beis Shvat today, which is actually exactly, it's the 10-year anniversary of my article that was my call to action article that appeared in the Jewish press on Chaf Beis Shvat
Wow.
2014 on the case for teaching digital citizenship. So this is actually
Did you get
a
a big response to that article? Was there was did it stir up some conversation, or were people like, no, not he's off?
I don't know. I don't know that I can pinpoint one moment where the shift happened. I certainly don't think it was the initial article came out, but it was certainly for me, it was the start. What happened was people, knew I had a doctorate and they knew I had something to do with technology. So I would be getting phone calls to do internet safety lectures. And all they wanted to hear about was, schmutz and filters. And I just said, that's not what I do. I'm looking at human behavior and the human behavior interaction with technology. And so I was asked to do that sort of lecture in Queens by a woman named Aviva Hach. And I said, it's to me, it's really not about that. It's about our relationship with technology and its impact on our overall functioning. So she sort of challenged me and said, well, if you're just saying that that's not what it is, you need to provide the resources to address what you're saying the challenge is. And she sort of challenged me to develop something to address what I was identifying as the big issue with technology.
So let me just take a moment to push back a little, because I imagine some of our listeners are saying, hold on. I mean, it's one thing to say that schmutz and filters is also an issue, but to say that the digital citizenship and how we act and bullying and sort of the looser social standards that exist online is the primary challenge, and the schmutz and the filters is a secondary challenge. First of all, is that really what you're saying? And second of all, please explain how you could justify that position.
So I'm saying it's that schmutz and filters are not the only challenge.
Okay.
And that was the dialogue at the time, that was the only challenge. And what I'm seeing in human behavior and psychological functioning, behavioral functioning, this seems to be extremely impactful on families as a whole, the overall functioning. And we've been talking about this for years about people's disengagement, their inability to connect, how they feel about themselves. And the research is all coming out now over the last few years about how impactful all of this is. The Surgeon General came out with a report a few months ago on the epidemic of loneliness and directly linked it to social media, that people are spending, they went in the last 15 years from spending 30 hours face-to-face interactions with other people to 10 hours per month within individual families. People are spending 5 hours less per month interacting with the people in their household. And we have this epidemic of loneliness, higher levels of anxiety, lower levels of subjective well-being, overall functioning. I mean, these are pretty significant issues that certainly when we started this weren't being discussed. And this is really what I felt like we brought to the table and part of the community conversation.
Would you say that it's true across the board, not even in the Jewish community or the Orthodox community, but broadly in society, that these aspects weren't focused on 10, 12 years ago, and now they've become more of a focus broadly?
I when what I was I think bringing the Jewish community was where I was speaking and where I was interacting, but it wasn't really being discussed all that much outside of the Jewish community either. One of the leaders now in this area is an entity called Common Sense Media, and when we started, like digital citizenship was like buried in like eight different levels on their website. It wasn't even something they focused on, but now it's become like the primary area of focus. And all the research, all the books that have been coming out about social media and technology's negative impact on overall functioning is all within the last 5 years, 6 years. So we sort of predated that by addressing it. And again, not because I was some innovative thinker. It just happened to be the area that I was focused on in my studies.
Oh, that's really cool that you're onto that. I remember a book that I got and read. Do you remember? It was a hyphenated name. It was a great book. She was the one who wrote a major article about the depression rates being linked to the Apple iPhone and in adolescence. Like she saw a trend that the depression rates became highest by 50%
The
of
Jean Twenge?
Jean
Yeah.
Twenge. I remember her
Twenge, yeah.
book as
I think
early
she's
on.
University of San Diego. Yeah, she was one of the early thinkers on this
It was
too.
early, yeah. When my daughter, who's now in 11th grade, wanted a phone, maybe when she was in 7th or 8th grade, I said, read this book. I gave her the book. I said, read this book, and then we'll have a conversation. You have to be educated about it. So she read the book with great interest. And
I believe Mark Zuckerberg just apologized for the negative impact. I think Senator Hawley had him in a congressional hearing and basically asked him to apologize, and he did.
okay, what's he doing about it?
What's interesting is that Facebook had internal research on social media's negative impact on adolescents, particularly female adolescents, and they did not release that information. So
I don't think Facebook is so popular right now amongst female adolescents. We're on to Snapchat and TikTok.
We're entering
Facebook is
we're
safe.
entering the age of AI, which is a whole new challenge. And we're a Digital Citizenship Project. We're looking at what lessons can we learn from social media to inform how we should be approaching AI.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. All right, let's pause here on the digital citizenship and let's talk about the consortium because I know you have a significant role there, and I'm curious, what is the consortium, how you got involved with it, and what your role is there?
Okay, good question. The Consortium of Jewish Day Schools is an organization that is dedicated to elevating the practice of Jewish education, working predominantly with schools around the country that are, I would say, centrist or community type schools. And in addition to a great Chumash curriculum called L'Havin U'L'Haskil, a lot of people are familiar with L'Havin U'L'Haskil, but unfamiliar that. It comes from the Consortium of Jewish Day Schools. People in the know, like yourself, are aware of that. But standardized curriculum and assessments, the JSAT, was really the foundation. Training administrators in best practices in school administration is also part of it. And so those are some of the earlier days of the Consortium of Jewish Day Schools. And they run a summer conference called the Think Tank that brings together principals from around the country to explore some of the challenges that Jewish day schools are experiencing, and coming up with solutions and strategies through workshops, education, and supports to help Jewish day schools. So I think that's consortium as a whole. But Summer Think Tank, I was invited by someone named Aaron Rosenthal to come speak at the second Summer Think Tank on digital citizenship and technology. So that was my introduction to the Consortium of Jewish Day Schools. I was asked to speak at their conference in the early days of the Digital Citizenship Project. As it turns out, I had known Rabbi Heshy Glass, who is the fearless leader of the organization. He was my principal when I was in kindergarten.
Oh, well, of course.
So that was I was actually in Florida at that point for early childhood. He was my principal. So we go back, and they say everything you need to know you learned in kindergarten. So I can accredit him with all of my career achievements.
So you spoke for them and then What happened?
And I was really impressed with the organization. That was my first exposure to it. And I, you know, I'd mentioned I'd already done project managing for YU when I was at Azrieli, and had developed some thoughts on things that could be done in schools and communities based on that experience. You know, I'd done the Brave management, but I was also the school affordability coordinator as well. So I had already had some experience in putting school leaders in a room to have conversations around challenges that they were facing, and I shared with Rabbi Glass that I think I have what to contribute to the organization. And again, I was impressed with the organization and the potential of the organization. So I started doing some projects for consortium, putting together some smaller conferences, and over time it evolved into a position. The Director of Educational Initiatives is my title. And I do work with schools and yeshivas around the country. Really, it's loosely defined in the sense that whatever schools need, I try to help with. I
Wow.
do it through training, through workshops, through education. But if there's a specific area where a school needs help in, you know, it's not limited to just the educational conferences.
So just for our listeners who are keeping track, I think we're up to three or possibly four jobs simultaneously. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure because you sort of have two jobs in your day job because you're in the schools, but you're also seeing patients. I guess
No,
we're still
yes,
doing that.
I'm not doing clinical work.
Okay, all right. So you're in the
Yeah.
schools during the
I'm in the
day, and then
school.
you're doing your digital citizenship project work, and then you're doing the consortium work.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you're doing that I should know about? Any hobbies?
I play guitar.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do.
Electric or acoustic?
Both.
When was the last time you played in front of 10 people?
In front of 10 people. I played end of December. I played Nefesh. There's an organization called Nefesh, the
Mental health.
International Association of Orthodox Mental Health Professionals.
How that's an acronym for Nefesh, we'll just leave.
Yeah, that was
Okay.
before my time. But I was invited to speak there. So I spoke at their conference. It was the end of December.
Whipped out the guitar.
Yeah, so we ended up playing Havdalah,
Yeah.
myself and Shirley Williger.
Oh,
He's
yeah. Okay.
a lot of fun.
Wow,
So
good
yeah,
for you. That's
that was the
awesome.
last time I played. Yeah.
Okay, so you do that, and we ha just finishing up the consortium. So, where do you see the organization evolving? Like, where is the energy there? Like, what are the needs that you guys that's emerging or that you see coming up, would you say?
So you know, it's interesting that one of the things that I really loved about consortium and continue to love about consortium is the ability to pivot, and when something comes up, to be able to be really responsive to it. It's a small organization, and so we're able to just be really responsive. So I would say over the last 3 years, we have developed a number of components within the organization. And so to start with, we developed something called JEDIT, a Jewish EdTech IT, run by Rabbi Baruch Noy, who is just a brilliant guy who understands IT, understands EdTech. We saw that there was a lack of support for yeshivas and day schools in this area, that they were, you know, looking at the devices and infrastructure and educational technologies. And we created this division of consortium to meet that need, so Jewish EdTech IT. We've also been finding, and it's funny considering my background that it took me so long to figure this out, but we were also finding that there was a significant mental health crisis within the day school and yeshiva population. Again, not dissimilar to the public school population. A recent report that was done by one of the national teacher associations, they surveyed kids and found that the number one impediment to their academic success was mental health issues.
Really? Wow.
Self-reporting kids. And it was interesting because it was about 51, 52% of kids said that mental health issues are the number one area that prevents them
Is that
from succeeding.
teenagers?
It was, I don't remember the
Juvenile?
population. It was, I think it was middle school, high school. And it was also interesting, in the same report, districts were only allocating about 10% of their resources, or additional resources towards mental health. support. So the idea that mental health being one of the number one issues, and it really we see, especially since COVID, there was a bump in anxiety. I think it's leveled out a little bit, but really family functioning challenges. And
What are you doing to address
so
that?
yeah, so we developed the mental health network within the consortium of Jewish day schools. So the mental health network has been focusing on this. We just recently had programming with Dr. David Rosmarin, who is an expert on anxiety, recently came out with a book, Thriving with Anxiety. And so bringing top level resources to Jewish day school leaders and their support staff is part of the Mental Health Network's initiative. We're working with Dr. Victor Fornari, who is the head of child and adolescent psychiatry at Northwell Health Systems in New York. So really also he's a world-renowned psychiatrist. Working with him, we have a fairly regular Mental Health Monday webinar where principals can come on and ask questions and his resources. So JETIT was developed, the Mental Health Network was developed, and right now we are in the process of putting together a general studies principal council to provide support specifically for general studies principals. And again,
Awesome.
there are a lot of resources out there, but not specifically Jewish in this sort of capacity. So from a consortium standpoint, the general piece is that we can be responsive when we identify needs, and the
Those are
most
all great. They all resonate with
yeah.
me, every one of those. So
Yeah.
you can add me to the list. And I've benefited, as you know, from many of your programs, and I was there with Dr. Rosemary, and I enjoyed it very much. So thank you for putting those together.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Okay, so back to the digital citizenship project. So where is the modality of most of your work? I know you came to Houston, you spoke, it was a great speech. People loved it. There was a tremendous amount of humor and balance because it's a serious topic. So I think it's healthy that you don't make it scary. But is that mostly what you do, speak in a community, or what's most of your work around that?
So, Digital Citizenship Project offers a variety of services and programs to schools and communities. Certainly, our most popular offering is the parent lecture, community lecture. It's how technology impacts functioning and what parents can do about it. And it's all research-based, data-driven. We also wrote a curriculum with the help of Tamima Feldman, who's a principal at Hafter in the Five Towns. When it came to developing a curriculum, even though I took courses in curriculum development, I really didn't have experience in it. And I had a lot of ideas and a lot of concepts. And she was able to take those ideas and concepts and really put it into a usable curriculum for schools. So we do a lot of training for schools in the curriculum. It's a train the trainers model where the teachers become familiar with digital citizenship and technology's impact on functioning. And then they are able to turnkey it and do workshops with students and create an environment within their schools where technology is something that can be discussed, explored, and supported, as opposed to, most kids, their paradigm on adults and technology is that the adults in the room are trying to take away our phones and our devices. But if you create an environment that is safe for them to talk about it, they'll be able to identify many of the negative aspects of technology and some of the challenges that they're facing. And as a result, teachers feel empowered to have those conversations and to create an environment where they can challenge themselves to better manage and better self-regulate their technologies. So the parent programs, the curriculum, faculty professional development, we utilize research. We do consulting with schools on policy development. That's become a big issue in helping schools develop a philosophy of education and technology, the interplay between how they approach technology, whether it's education, whether it's policies. So we help work with schools and their parent population. And we also do something called fireside chats, where we work with parents to help them develop a consensus on what their expectations are with their kids and with their grade levels when it comes to technology. One of the biggest challenges we found that parents have is something we call BEH, BEH. It does not stand for Be'ezras Hashem. It stands for But Everyone Has. And parents don't want their kids to be left out. And so it's very often the social norms that dictate the drive for technology or gaming or phones or whatever it might be. So we bring parents together and help them build consensus, whether it's, no smartphones in kindergarten, whatever, or shutting down by 9 p.m., whatever the standards that we could do, or no social media. If we can build consensus, it really takes away the social pressures of giving kids devices or access to content and media that they're not so comfortable with, but feel the communal pressure or with class pressure to do so.
I'm wondering, you see a wide range of schools and different communities and religious levels, et cetera. Would you say that there's broad differences in the community, or would you say that pretty much technology has been fully integrated, even the more right-wing places, even though it's not obvious, but really when you scratch below the surface, you really find the same level of technological integration? Or would you say that it's a very different experience based on the community?
I think it really differs from community to community. I think COVID had a tremendous impact on technology integration. Many families that never would have thought that they would have tablet devices in their home or even internet. There was a community I spoke in recently, South Bend, Indiana, where a lot of families didn't have internet in their homes until COVID. What I have found is that there's a lot of variation. I can't speak for some of the Hasidic communities or even the Lakewood community. I'm just a lot less familiar with those communities. But some whether it's Metro New York or Chicago or L.A. or even smaller communities like Houston or Memphis, there is a lot of variation. I think the affordability of technology was a big influencer on whether people adopted it or not. Early on, I saw more of a socioeconomic influence over whether people had smartphones or were engaged with more internet, more as a socioeconomic influence than a religiosity influence. We had right-wing communities that were wealthy that had devices and had the
Interesting.
latest tech.
Wow.
And you had, I would say more centrist or modern Orthodox communities that may have, particularly in out-of-town communities, that were less technologically engaged. And it seemed that it was more of a socioeconomic. But I didn't study it.
That's
I don't have
really
the data
cool.
for it. It's just a more observation than anything else.
And what about rabbinic influence, pushback, or positive? Like, how have you found the rabbinic leadership with regard to what you're trying to communicate?
I overall, I would say that from rabbinic leadership, I have to say, the Torah Masorah, the Aguda organizations like that have been really open to, what I've brought to the table. They've given me a platform for which I'm very grateful for, and speaking at their conferences and speaking at their events. There are certain communities and schools that have taken more of a legislative approach to technology as opposed to an educational one. What I primarily offer is an educational approach. And so some communities have definitely taken a legislative approach and just either, banned smartphones or, banned internet in their communities. Again, I think there's been a shift since COVID, but that definitely seen more legislation, less education in certain communities. But what's also interesting is in some of the centrist and modern Orthodox communities that I work with, who adopted more education, they are shifting now to policy in at rates that I wouldn't have expected, and really, some strong policies on, students are not allowed to have social media. I don't know how they're implementing it or regulating it, but they are very concerned about its impact and have taken a more legislative approach than they have in the past. So I think there's been a shift there. And I think in some of the more right-wing communities, they're adopting more education than they have in the past.
Interesting. So everyone's sort of finding their
Yeah.
balance.
Yeah.
Is there a community or a school that you think is really nailing it? Like, if you had to say this school has adopted a lot of good policies and they have really done a great job of, I wouldn't say eradicating, but in some way limiting the negative influences of technology on their community.
But I wouldn't feel comfortable saying a specific school's name to the exclusion of schools that might think they're doing a good job. And since I didn't
But
say
in your
them,
mind, are there
they,
schools like
yeah,
that
there are
really?
schools. There are definitely schools that are doing a better job than other schools. It's really, a challenge for school leaders, and it's something that we understand from an implementation standpoint. Technology is so powerful and so encumbering that it's hard to really address it in a holistic, comprehensive way when you're running a school. I mean, at the
Right.
end of the day, you're running a school, and there are so many obligations that go along with it that to just, unless you dedicate someone full time to just focus on the technology piece of it, it's very hard to address it, I would say, in a best practices approach. Even the curriculum, which I think is really important, where are you fitting curriculum into a day that already it's a dual curriculum, and now I have to add, digital citizenship to it, and the challenges and posters and community challenges and class challenges. It really requires a high degree of commitment. Then you have the policies, and then balancing, we haven't even talked about technology from a pedagogic standpoint. How are schools deciding to what degree kids are using technology as part of the homework? Are they using a Google Classroom? Are homeworks being uploaded to be provided to teachers and to students? In the classroom itself, smart boards came out a while ago. For many who were trained in smart board use, it was a very valuable tool. For others, it just became show videos on this platform. And so having a thoughtful and deliberative approach to using it from a pedagogic standpoint. And then if I'm using it as a pedagogic standpoint, are parents happy when I'm educating them? Well, your kids shouldn't be on computers, but now they have social studies homework on the computer and you said not to use computers. And so it requires a high degree of commitment. And not because schools don't want to, but I think as you as a school leader could probably talk more about this than I can. It's really hard to, fulfill all the obligations as a school leader. And then now that technology has advanced to a degree where it's so enmeshed in our systems and functioning to really knock it out of the park and be
Right.
perfect with
That's a good
it.
point. And then also realize while you're doing digital citizenship, there's a security guy who's all worried about the security. And then there's the nutritionist guy and the physical activities guy and the literacy guy. It's like a million different Mishnayos guy. And if you only pick one guy, you're good. But if you want to incorporate every guy, you're in trouble, man.
No, so
So.
it's interesting. There was a school I was working at a number of years ago, not a Jewish school. This student happened to be Jewish. He was attending an independent non-public school, and he was in like fifth grade, and he was a mess. He was a mess academically, socially. He walked around the building just disheveled, and like he looked like, if you could picture like a fifth grader who looked hungover, that's what he looked like. And we had a meeting, and the literacy person said, "Oh, it's definitely reading challenges, and he's like really struggling." And the drug counselor was like, "No, there's a substance abuse issue here." And of course, I'm like, "No, there's definitely a technology issue." And
That's right.
so we called the mom in, and we had this meeting with the mom, and we said we're concerned. And so I said, "By the way, is your child up late at night with a device?" She's like, "Yeah, he's on his iPad till 4 in the morning every night, and this is a fifth grader." I said, "Well, have you considered,
Limiting them.
giving him, taking the iPad away, having him give to you at, 10 o'clock?" And her response was, "But it's his." Right? That was wrong. So I knew that this was not a technology issue. It was an overall parenting issue.
Right, much broader.
But we're seeing that. And so obviously I always, think that it's always going to be a technology issue. But you're right, to your point, the Mishnah guy is going to think it's a Mishnah issue.
Okay, just as we start to close up here, I just wanted to, how have things changed, like in your curriculum, in your focus? Has it changed over the last 10 years in terms of your message or what you're seeing?
So when we designed the digital citizenship curriculum, we really wanted to focus on psychological fundamentals, that it didn't really matter what medium of technology you were using. This is how technology impacts human behavior. And so technology's impact on human behavior is relatively consistent. It promotes impulsivity, it promotes disinhibition, it promotes miscommunication, desensitization, its impact on resilience, its impact on grit. We didn't even talk about that piece of it, but that's in the curriculum as well. So whether we're dealing with Google websites and that, or we're dealing with social media, or we're moving into the era of AI, its impact is relatively all the same. And if people can understand and be thoughtful and deliberative and self-aware of how technology is impacting their functioning, they will make better decisions no matter what the next phase or, medium or advancement in technology is. It's a self-awareness and self-regulation. It's parenting self-awareness
The fundamentals are very similar.
Yeah, the fundamentals don't really change, or we haven't seen it significantly change, even though the mediums,
Now we have those goggles. You saw the face, Google.
yeah,
No,
the
Apple.
Apple,
Apple
yeah,
Vision. They
Apple.
sold out. I
Oh,
couldn't believe
really?
it.
I saw.
$4,000 a piece. They're sold out. Unbelievable. Wait till we walk around with those all day.
So, I've been talking about augmented reality for a while, and now with AI, and virtual reality, and I recently, when I spoke at the Nefesh conference, a month or so ago, I talked a lot about AI and chatbots and generative AI and people formulating relationships with chatbots that are designed to understand you. And using artificial intelligence and being responsive in that way. I was talking to a group of clinical therapists and basically said, you can have a chatbot that's trained to provide therapy for clients. They're going to be a
Wow.
lot cheaper. And you can select, do I want cognitive behavioral therapy? Do I want psychoanalytic therapy? And by allowing the chatbot to go through, read your emails and read and be have awareness of it, it'll learn who you are and be able to be responsive. With higher rates of accuracy than a therapist might. So that's something to think about of that. Or here's where it might go in the Frum community. What if I could have a chavrusa that it's an avatar with a nice long white beard and it's called Torah Kula, all the Mefarshim, the Rishonim, Achronim, and it knows my learning style, it knows how I think, and I can have this digital artificial intelligence as a chavrusa.
Oh.
Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? So these are, I think, some of the challenges we're going to be seeing in the very near future. And, we need to be thoughtful on how we approach that.
Unbelievable, really unbelievable. All right, wonderful. Is there anything else that you think we should cover when exploring digital citizenship, that we didn't cover?
No, I feel very strongly about the topic. I can, we can do a multi-day podcast on the topic. And I think the one message is then the biggest challenge around technology is self-regulation, is regulating technology use, and the strategy around that is being thoughtful and deliberative and strategic. I think we all on any given day have to ask ourselves, is technology serving as an enhancement in my life or is it serving as an intrusion? And there are going to be some days where it's more of enhancement and some days it's going to be more of an intrusion. And so I think the goal is to take a fearless, they say in the 12-step recovery, taking a fearless moral inventory of our relationship with technology, and where are we with our own families, and is it serving as an enhancement or intrusion, and making better decisions around technology use so that we can benefit from the great opportunities that it presents and avoid many of the inherent challenges.
Give me a Shapiro family rule. I want to know one of the family rules of the king of digital citizenship. Just throw out, if you're a Shapiro, you'll get it. Everyone else will just listen in. Give us an insider. What is like one of your rules?
So we do something called going dark for dinner,
Tell us
where
about
there's
that. Just one.
yes, yeah. This is my daughter came up with this a number of years ago, and she said, "Wouldn't it be nice if we like sat around the dinner table and had like a formal dinner where I would sit at one end, I'd say, please pass the salt, and that they're like, sure, here's the salt here, and what interferes with that for most families is that we have our cell phones at the table and we're checking them compulsively, not because we get notifications, but the minute there's a void in a conversation, we check our phone. So we have a rule during dinner time. There are no phones at the table or in the room, not even in your pocket. It goes into a different room. And I can tell you that it has certainly enhanced. We've been doing it for many, many years at this point. That's like a very
That's a
simple
good
one
one. That's
that
wonderful.
I think every family can incorporate.
Yeah. I think let's do one. One is good. I think more than one, we're done.
Okay.
Well, Dr. Shapiro, this was such a joy. I'm a big fan of yours, as you know. I love spending time with you in each one of your hats. And you're also as a good friend and personal hat. Amritz Hashem, we'll continue to get together. And I thank you for coming on. Really been
It's my
great.
pleasure. It's an honor to be, the podcast king is like, wow.
Hey, listen, if you can't beat them, join them, baby.
Yeah.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.